Dr. Coons, today we're going to be talking about political theology as a term used to help distinguish ways in which various movements, people groups, nations, tongues, religions, I don't know, how do you want to categorize them, have addressed the relationship, the existence of the power of the sword, as opposed to, I'm just going to kind of throw out there, the power of the word. Normally thought of as church and state relations by most Americans. It's a very, very modern way of talking about a much older struggle, maybe is the best word for it. How does the governing ones relate to the truth of what worshiping God means? And how have different groups said, well, you know, this is the way that it is. So we're heading out on a little, you know, embarkment here to discover this. Why don't you start off by just telling us why this is going to form or help as a framework again, the listener?
We're using the framework provided by Andy Nasselli, who wrote an article called What is the Spectrum of Major Views on Political Theology? Because it's not comprehensive and it's also not telling you exactly what to think, but giving you a wide view of what is going on in a sector that actually has had a name for a long time and unfortunately is relatively unknown probably to most of the listeners. So if I just said political theology to most people, they would probably think that the adjective there, political, is some kind of pejorative, like I go to church and my pastor just preaches political sermons, meaning he doesn't talk about the Bible. He's just sort of spouting whatever his, you know, ideas are. And that happens in John Hagee's church. And that happens, and I can tell you from personal experience, political sermons are most of what you get in liberal Protestantism. I mean, you're basically getting whatever MSNBC's talking points are at that time, or whatever the source is, that's what you're going to get, right? They exist as just, you know, repeater stations for whatever the left is promoting at any given time. So that's probably the way that people might naturally think of the term political theology. Political theology is used in a technical way, and that's the way that Nasselli's using it, to talk about what someone's theology, or where the person is atheistic in the case of the first category he uses that we'll go into, someone's ideology or concept of how politics and religion relate to each other. So pretty much any society is going to have some idea of religion and of politics, even if their idea of religion is to say it's fake or it's a delusion or it's a merely psychological phenomenon. They're still going to have some idea of how they relate to each other. And political theology is what covers that. So basically everybody has a political theology, but very few people either know that term, fine, doesn't matter that much, but also for that reason, I think begin to frame things in ways that are unhelpful to themselves. And we'll see that, for instance, the phrase, like you mentioned, church state, is kind of a rough one to use because it ends up not really telling you what is the state supposed to be doing, right? Where at least government, or even more vivid terms like the sword or the power of the sword, give you some sense of what it is that the government is supposed to be engaged in, or what politics is ultimately about, that there is a punitive and even dangerous nature to politics baked into how it's set up. Political theology enables you to kind of think in those broad ways that are helpful. And I hope, like this article, which we will have in the show notes, to be clarifying to people rather than for people just to sort of stumble through life because religion doesn't seem to change quick enough or doesn't respond to what's going on in politics. And politics is constantly changing. And their relationship, therefore, becomes more and more unclear. And hopefully what we talk about and what people can find not only in this article, but through this article, will be clarifying for them.
Yeah. I found the article helpful in two ways, which I already mentioned off the air, but early on, some real good ontology seeking for why the we're calling anything what we're calling it. What's religion? What's that word mean? And that's where I want to go next. But then, you know, into these bullet points of structure, which isn't really so much like, well, this is the right answer or this is the wrong answer, but this is an answer that's out there to this question.
Yeah.
But before we can really ask the question, I mean, the question is sort of asking, what are these things? What is church? What is state? What is government? What is religion?
Right.
And he starts off by defining religion. And this is where my notes are not going to be as good as your mind, because what I wrote down is what I think versus what he said. I didn't disagree entirely with what he said. I just thought it was limited. So I'd rather have you take it from that point rather than skew the waters at this point.
Religion is famously hard to define. And when you tell somebody that you're religious, adjective, not noun, they are almost immediately thinking of something that's organized. He's not using, and people who study these things actually don't use religion in the sense of it's necessarily being organized. So his definition of an organized system of beliefs that answers ultimate questions and commends certain actions or behaviors based on the answers to those questions is not, I think, actually true. I would take out the word organized in that sentence and just leave system of beliefs that answers ultimate questions. And he's using the term religion rather than church, like in church-state relations or wall of separation between church and state, in order to cover not only non-Christian organized religions such as Islam, which he'll discuss as, you know, basically theocracy in a very strict sense that we'll get to maybe this week, maybe next week, I don't know. But he's using the term religion to cover what is called and what people who study religion call secularism. And the reason that's extremely helpful is that it covers regimes not only such as the Soviet Union that are very, very forthright about being atheistic, but it also covers, for instance, our regime, where obviously religious claims are being made, for instance, about the nature of human beings by saying that their gender is a matter of social assignment and not of biology. That's a very deep claim about humanity that in basically every other society ever has been put under some organized, forthright religion. But in our society, claims about human beings, because our regime is not religious and can't be, both for historical reasons, but also for very present ideological reasons.
Just like the emperor clearly has the most beautiful coat on I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is something unusually perverse about modern day life, is that all kinds of religious claims are being incessantly made. I mean, every time someone says that my therapist said, you know, this is, and that's going to affect your marriage, right? That's going to maybe end your marriage. I don't have any idea how that's different from my pastor said or my priest said, except that my therapist said has much greater social sanction than my pastor said or my priest said. And so people are much likelier to follow what their therapist said than what their pastor or their priest said. And they were probably talking to the therapist long before they sought the divorce. Whereas with the pastor or the priest, they're probably telling, you know, Pastor Smith or Father Jones after they've resolved to get to the divorce. So that's one way that you can tell, you know, how does this sanction, or am I just going to inform this religious figure later on after I've already decided something? You can tell what has the most power, religiously speaking. And we're not dealing with a system that believes that it is religious. It in fact banishes explicitly religious thoughts as well as explicitly religious texts from public discussion.
Religiously, you might say.
Yeah, and it's not an accident. I mean, and this is where we've said this many times on the show, but you have to stop and think about, this is not like some sort of Fox News war on Christmas, you know, tier stuff. You can't just think about, are you allowed to have a, you know, Christian song in the public school holiday pageant, right? When you get things like vocabulary change or the banishment of certain material, you're dealing not just with, you know, this opposition to what a majority in that public school might be completely comfortable with or whatever. You're also dealing with what is being substituted. And the thing that is particularly tricky about the way that our regime operates is that the substitutions come under the name of neutrality, whereas similar regimes that were similarly atheistic in practice, right? Because if you, let's say you go to public school and then you go to Stanford University, what are the chances that you're going to end up as some kind of believing Christian? They're very low, right? We're talking about probabilities and large populations and how statistically things work out for them. Chances that you go to public school, good public schools, right? And then you go to Stanford or you go to Duke or you go to Columbia or whatever, right? Like you are completely plugged into the power network that our regime uses for cultivating people, which revolves around credentials. Chances that you're a believing Christian are slim to none. Slim to none. They're very small because everything is going to tell you religion is a stupid thing or religion is for low status people. Some religions are okay in the sense that they are the preserve of special groups who deserve special consideration. And that could be Muslims and that could be Jews. And when Muslims and Jews are in conflict with each other, you can see the regime is in conflict with itself, which is why the State Department and the White House are yelling at each other in memos right now as we speak. But the issue here is that religion as an actual practice that you would possibly have in a serious way, particularly and especially Christianity, just not on the table. So our regime doesn't, however, say, oh, that, you know, explicitly, that's evil. The method here is rather substitution and substitution and substitution with things, concepts, practices, religious figures who do not and never would announce themselves as religious. That doesn't mean that they don't have an idea about what reality is or where the universe came from or how we ourselves can stop the universe from melting into heat death by driving electric cars or whatever the solution is. It's just that it won't announce itself as religious. So I think Nicelli using the term religion to talk about all of these things, how religion and government relate to each other, it's very helpful because it captures what is actually going on among us, which is almost never about, strictly speaking, Christianity's relationship to politics. That's a debate Christians have, but that's not really what's on the table or what's on offer generally in our country. That's more about how the secular relates to politics.
Yeah, I love all this. I'm just not entirely convinced that a non-Christian can participate in a government that's not a religion to him. And I'm also not convinced that a Christian can do it because we're in a kingdom. And so our religion is a government that is, you know, coming, has some orders for here. And then a lot of that has to do with like work with the religious government that's there, you know, that all the pagans are in and are breaking probably. So, you know, that can probably be left for debate or insertion later. But to see then that the science of politics, so-called, is not what most people will use when they refer to the term politics, you know, pastor, don't be political.
Right.
Oh, you want the sink in the bathroom to keep flowing. I shouldn't turn it off. I shouldn't, you know, call the plumber, none of that, right? Because politics, is it political? The art of the city, the art of our gathering together as humans, it does start in the home, honestly, where the father is king, right? But then to come together ever as a people and care about what we have, that's just what the word politics meant. And because it's filled with dirty, wicked men, now we don't like the word, but you're kind of blaming the wrong part.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the idea that somehow there's going to be a human society without politics, which Nicelli paraphrases Aristotle to describe as the science and the art of governing men, is silly. if you have no elections, you still have politics. If you have elections incessantly, you have politics that have nothing to do with elections. Because what you're dealing with classically in politics is how to achieve things in human groups, whatever the decision-making procedure is, whatever the governing structure is, whatever the size of the governing class is going to be, whether you're going to say, well, it's potentially every adult, which is what we say. Not I, but, you know, we modern people. And you can set that up however you want. You're going to have politics. And the reason you're going to is because you need to figure out how to achieve things in that group. With those specific structures, with that specific governing class, whatever that structure, whatever that setup is, fine. You're still going to have to get something achieved. And Nicelli is using that broad discussion, not using politics as a pejorative, like you're playing politics or you're being political in a way that's illegitimate. And I think that some of that is driven by, there's kind of two sources here. One is deeper than the other. This is me, not Nicelli. People don't like politics because, and I think this is the deeper one, most people really are not set up to continually make decisions, which is what is involved in politics. There's the art of managing human beings. There are kinds of knowledge that are needed, a knowledge of money, a knowledge of war making, lots of things. But a lot of people are just not set up to think on that scale, and they don't want to. And that's fine. That's totally fine. I wish that our form of government took more cognizance of that fact, that yes, people want some measure of decision-making capacity over their own lives. Totally true. But the idea that they're all set up, this is not just like a question of, you know, what does the average American understand about Jordan's relationship to Israel?
Yeah.
Or, you know, all the different, right? I mean, like,
I don't understand what basketball has to do with it, man.
Yeah, that's right. But so this is not just a question of like, you know, I'm smart and people who aren't smart shouldn't be voting. Like, it's more like human beings are generally not set up, most of us, to know or care about hardly anything 100 miles away, let alone 1,000 or 5,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And asking us to make decisions about human beings who are themselves supposed to know about those things and do something about those things 5,000 miles away, it was always a dicey proposition. And this is where you have to recognize that nobody was trying to run a republic on anything like the scale that we're trying today.
Ever.
Republics are always small governments. And I don't just mean like they don't have a large bureaucracy. They are physically small. They are Vermont, you know, not Texas. So that's the deeper reason, is I'm not really sure human beings are set up to think on this scale in a widespread way.
No.
The more shallow reason is this, that people think of politics as bad because they are unaccustomed to being serious about life. You need to do politics to convince other people of things, to get other people to be organized. The reason that you can check out, okay, from your city, your church, your state, whatever level of politics, of human groups you're talking about, is because somehow it's running itself. Okay. If it doesn't run itself, then maybe you'll actually care. But you can be unserious about things and not participate in them when and if they obviously just don't matter, right? So you're probably not on your library board unless you're really upset about the books they're buying, which probably maybe you should be.
Most likely, right? Yeah.
Right. but there's a dislike of politics because maybe for that deeper reason I mentioned, maybe for other reasons, we've just been accustomed to things working. People don't feel that it's necessary for other people to be engaged. So if you're saying, I wouldn't ask your pastor, like, are you preaching political sermons? I would ask him, like, do you participate in our church on a broader level at all? Or just as an example, right? Because churches have politics too. And is he engaged in that at all? Maybe he doesn't need to be. That's fine. But if he's going to be upset about what's going on in the church, but he's not engaged, that's not fine. And politics also involves, and this is kind of an endorsement on it, politics involves the open structures of how governing works. It doesn't mean, you know, whispering in dark corners or hunting people on the internet. When that happens, when a government, a form of government, whether it's a church or a state or whatever, is overtaken by whispering in dark corners or hunting people on the internet, that's the sign that it's almost about to collapse because nobody is even bothering to use the publicly available fora for dealing with anything, right?
Yeah, aside from to win like small battle points, right? It's all about claiming territory.
I think that a government that nobody's even bothering to participate in anymore obviously has no legitimacy. And you can go to specific points in history and look and say, okay, December of 1860, after Lincoln's elected and months before he takes office, there's a lot of stuff going on in Washington, D.C. because the Congress is still in session and Buchanan is still president. But most of what is real that's actually going to matter like 6 months from that date is going on in secret, or it's not going on there, even when it concerns people who are there, like Jefferson Davis, who was still a senator from Mississippi at the time. So you're dealing with a situation when things recede into secrecy. And this happens in congregations. This happens in families, is that things recede into secrecy and they don't just get solved there because on the surface, you're all politically pretending like everything is fine. They instead sort of fester there, like, you know, mushrooms growing in darkness. And that just means that politics will only be played by people who love secrecy and whispering and slander, rather than people who are publicly actually charged with dealing with things out there in public. So politics is the art and science of governing men. And I would say specifically an add to this definition that Nocelli uses, I would say especially the science and art of governing men publicly, not privately. You're not running over everything in their lives. I'm tipping my hand as to my understanding between of how religion and politics relate to each other, because I don't believe that politics is actually intended to solve everything about your private life. Lots of modern people think it is, and it should, and it does.
I took a lot from his hat tip to Aristotle's definition of politics as the government of young men, particularly. So the purpose of politics is that those of us who are here have to kind of make sure those of us who are newer don't like ruin it, right? And that's kind of the art. And so these young men coming up, our own sons, the outsider would be the same kind of mindset in Solomonic Hebrew thought, right? The young and the fool are kind of the same. So in one sense, then politics is the art of those who can see, helping those who can't see, so that we can all do well together. The challenge then is when everyone says, I can see, and we're all blind, right? And when the blind lead the blind, I believe our Lord said, they fall into a pit. And so you end up, you know, double blind here with this kind of a, you know, super secret, who's going to win the next whatever. And so we can put in place more plans no one knows about until 10 years from now when they come to fruition. And then we will be the saviors of the world. All of that's fun for game night. But, you know, for now, into the idea that nation states exist and they do try to do so in the modern age without religion by verbiage, right? So they claim to be unreligious. I still, from my own head, cannot see religion as something that would, if something were irreligious, then it would be without ritual. It would be without symbol. It would be without spirit. I'm not sure that the true Marxist would go that far. Probably. Maybe. I don't know. But that is kind of where they're pushing with the whole thing. Now, and that's where then we're being pushed into trying to distinguish church and state, the most radical form of distinction between so-called church and state, whose prophet Marx, everyone knows. There are others in history who could be put to this, but it basically has that the government is over all religions.
Yeah.
And all religions, whatever they are not true. Like the government is true. And that's why, again, so that's just your religion is government at that point, is how I understand that myself, but take it from
yeah,
there.
Yeah. And this is view one in this taxonomy, and the historic example that's used to define it is Karl Marx, but it's probably a lot more productive for us to understand that what is called secular suppression, where the government just eliminates religion. So there's no tension, there's no difficulty, there's no enduring question of what spheres they will respectively occupy. So maybe religion could just talk about things that if you're not religious, you just get covered by psychology or your therapist. Instead, religion is gradually just eclipsed or abolished. And what's going on there is that you can very easily get to that position from the default American position of separation of church and state, that once they are separate, and then once you have made religious affiliation not only optional, but even more than that, distasteful, you very easily slip into the idea that religion is simply something that is dangerous, and therefore you have to get rid of it the same way that you might try to get rid of an infestation of an invasive species or whatever it is that you're trying to preserve well-meaning people and communities from. So Nicelli's not going to list not only the Soviet Union and North Korea, but also secular progressivism here, because it really has absolutely no need for, and at this point would rather suppress religion. And you get instances of this not only in specific measures taken or the hostility displayed to churches. Basically, the more secular the regime during COVID, the greater hostility displayed toward churches meeting at all, existing at all, right? And that was a test case, right? That wasn't necessarily the route pursued by everyone everywhere. That was a test case. But you get this also reflected in voting demographics, that if you tell somebody conducting a survey, "I don't believe in God," it's basically certain that you are a leftist of some kind, and probably you are on the left of your own nation's political left. So what happens is that gradually, in some cases, and very radically, generally in openly Marxist regimes, religion is suppressed very viciously. Okay. The gradualness of our own nation, for example, which is partly a function of just the sheer weight present and historic of the Christian church in America, means that they generally cannot pursue this tactic. But when they can, they do, right? So religion just gets banished as a matter of discussion. And therefore, no one's educated in these things unless his parents basically pay an extra tax of homeschooling, whatever that costs, or private school tuition in order to give him some kind of religion. And then it's still sort of it's house favoring odds whether he's going to end up actually being religious in the religion that his parents gave him after having paid that tax for however many years his education lasted. So you're dealing with a situation where gradually, in our case, but, and you can see this in numbers, you know, the lower the demographic you go in age in America, the less religious it is. But immediately and suddenly, in the case of, say, East Germany, which is supposed to be like, you know, Lutheran heartland or something, I'm supposed to have special feelings when I see pictures of Wittenberg or something. And that's an emotional defect in me that I don't have those special feelings. But, you know, that was very suddenly and very intentionally secularized under the East German regime. It's easily the most atheistic, right? And so by some measures, that's your more conservative part of modern Germany, but certainly not on a religious measure. So secular suppression, whether it goes fast or slow, the goal is always that religion just gets abolished eventually.
And this does happen in history. It's not something that we are safe from.
Yeah, this is not a theoretical thing. And I mean, it's easily observable in families. I mean, I don't know if you've had this, but in both my parishes, you're burying a Christian. You're working with the family who was raised in Christianity, who are probably boomers or Xers in generational terms. So they came up during the middle to, early latter third of the 20th century. And the grandkids, and maybe even there are great grandkids, are totally irreligious. And I've ministered in two very different parts of the country, same phenomenon, right? So it's, like smartphones, this is not really like regionally unique or just a function of, certain religious demographics that vary by your city or your region or your state or whatever. This is a general process, obviously readily carried out through the educational system, but available in so many other ways that first religion became highly optional and kind of irrelevant to life because it didn't involve getting ahead in life or the other goals that were given to the generation that was raised in Christianity. And then once the practice declined, it's really easy to move on to other things. What replaces those other things has varied regionally. I would say people in the West are into more often spiritual but not religious types of things. Sort of weird beliefs about being buried in nature, for example. And that really didn't happen in southeastern Pennsylvania. They would just kind of go into nothing with a general historic respect for Christianity. So different versions of secular, but I mean, they're not going to church regardless, right? They're asking me how to dress for the funeral, right? Because they have no idea what's going on. And, great grandkids are saying things like, whose house is this? This is a really big house. Whose house is this? So at that point, I mean, even the word God is just missing. No, it's God's house. Well, who's God? Right? They don't know.
The capacity to look at the state of the family in actual effect as a direct measurement of the current government, a prospectus of what we can expect as well, when you look at the paths the children are taking. I think that's a pretty important thing you just did there. I also think that if and when such a government arises, being an Anabaptist doesn't make no sense at all. It makes a whole lot of sense, actually. So go there.
Yeah. So view two is historically really just Anabaptists, meaning Mennonites, basically. Not Baptists. I want to be clear about that.
Meaning like both groups are poorly named, although rebaptism is what they both do, but like, right. But neither of them does the name really clarify anything for us.
The branding is better on Baptist than Anabaptist for sure. But what Anabaptist theology says historically and in the present day, this is going to be probably most famously in America, Stanley Hauerwas, is that government and religion are two totally different things. They have totally different jobs. Sort of unobjectionable. We'll go on. But because of that, and because the government is worldly and bears the sword, Christians have nothing to do with it. So historically, this involved Anabaptists, for instance, did not vote. That's not really actually true for Anabaptists in America today. They do vote. They don't always vote, but when they do. I mean, the Amish turned out for Trump everywhere. So they do vote. Historically, they didn't do that.
Did they vote on computers? machines. So
probably, you know, it being, you know, Pennsylvania, probably not a technologically savvy place.
So I see the results showed that they turned out for Trump is probably the more important question.
Yeah, the results
go on with reality instead of my silly jokes.
But this means you're just out. And this is a strategy that Nicelli doesn't say this, but this is a strategy that I think is reflexively feels comfortable to a lot of conservative Christians, because it just means that you try to get out and you're just going to kind of have your life and be left alone and, you know, Benedict option, whatever your vision of that is on an aesthetic level, you're just out and you are alone. The difficulty there is this is neither biblically sustainable, as we'll discuss, nor is this an option that is practically workable. On a biblical level, it's not forbidden to Christians to engage in the processes of government and the science and art of governing men publicly. That's not forbidden to them. And the Augsburg Confession for Lutherans defines this really clearly in talking about men being able to wage just wars and engage in just lawsuits and a variety of things that Anabaptists have always shunned. Okay. This is also not practically workable in that it always means that you will end up despising things that could help your neighbor. Okay. Because you're refusing to take up the reins of government. But it also means that you're probably just going to be pummeled and you have no recourse, because you believe it's beneath you to have recourse to the means for instance, defending yourself or defending others that government allows you to do, right? That the idea of government permits, whether you're talking about the natural right of self-defense, or you're talking about the governing structures that have been set up by men, but you know, that's how it works where you are, and that's what you use to make sure that injustice doesn't prevail everywhere. So this second view is interesting, because if you combine it with the first view of secular suppression, and I've seen Christians do this. I mean, this was kind of the reflex a lot of people had with gay marriage. They said, well, we'll just make marriage a matter of, you know, religious sanction only. Like, it's going to have nothing to do with the state. So you get to stay pure, right? I mean, I think driving view number two here is the idea that you get to stay pure because you're just not involved with the impure. You're out. Okay. And what you get then is you become really conveniently and by your own action as irrelevant as the government wants you to be. And all they have to do then is not to keep hunting you. They just need to pick off enough of your children to suppress religion successfully. Because you're saying, please leave me alone. I just want to be left alone. I'll be pure over here. I won't do anything bad. I'll be good. I can stay in my lane. Fine. Great. Go over there. We need to fight to hold on to your kids or get enough of your kids by whatever means we have. And this is, you know, this is something where you can see that what really irks people about religious people is usually concerned something about children, how many children they have, how they're educating their children. This is the source of fascination for the various shows that have been made about Amish kids growing up and thinking about whether or not they want to be Amish, right? Is that the idea that the religious get to educate and hold on to their own children is particularly offensive, because it makes the idea of suppression harder and harder and harder, especially if they have more children than people who are irreligious, which they do basically regardless of what their religion is. So the idea that you're just going to like go be left alone is crazy. Of course you're not, right? Of course you're not. But that's the dream. That's the Anabaptist dream.
Yeah, it is. And you got to see how, if you're going to do it, you're all in. And so the Amish are all in, and yet there they are having to vote, because at some point you must defend yourself with something. And if voting doesn't, to your mind, call up the power of the sword, well, again, we'll just have to talk later about that.
Right.
You said that Harwas had a bit about, or was this just this view that the church and the state have two different like vocations? Did I hear that right? We went past it. You're like, we'll go past this. And I was kind of like, well, okay. I'm just curious about that point.
Harwas understands the relationship between the church and the state to be that the church is a separate group resident in various states with a completely different purpose that completely claims the lives of those who are in that separate group. And that's
apart from their life in the state.
They don't have a life in the state.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why the most famous book of his is called Resident Aliens.
Right.
Because it's like you are a citizen of whatever, I don't know, Malawi, and you live in the United States.
Yeah.
You're not a citizen of the United States. There's just so much you legally cannot participate in.
So did I just read dual citizenship into that book when I read that book? I mean, because I came away from
it. You did. Right. When you read that book, you were reading a certain Lutheran permutation twist on that idea into that book.
Right on.
The book is not an endorsement of Lutheranism. It is an endorsement of Anabaptist theology. I mean, Harwas calls himself an Anglican Anabaptist, meaning liturgically he likes, and I think he is a member of the Episcopal Church. Theologically, because theology doesn't have
an Anglican submits to the throne. I don't get it.
Well, I mean, it doesn't. You know, an Anglican thinks whatever he, she, or Zier wants to think.
Yeah, these days,
right,
for sure.
So, theologically, he's an Anabaptist. Liturgically, he's an Anglican, and I think he's an interesting figure because it's basically at that point you have the Benedict option.
Yeah,
you got the trad liturgy, you got all the trad aesthetics. And you get to be left alone.
So where I was going with my bit on the question is that I'm just not sure I even know what the church and the state having two distinct purposes doesn't make any sense to me as any kind of claim. Ultimately, I can totally get how if we're going to kind of splice some categories for the sake of us playing in a sandbox. All right, church day, let's, whatever. But this idea that they're not both ultimately for the good of man, I just, or something like that to me, and maybe I'm just reading too much into that, but I don't know, this whole framework is fraught with kind of a light, not lighthearted is the wrong word. With fragile language, I'll say it that way, with fragile language, you know, we're building on historical ideas and groups who were, we have, you know, relics of them. Their ideas are still among us. And yet at the end, you know, what are we really trying to do with the conversation? The Anabaptists may say, you know, we don't participate, right? But then are there any that can actually achieve that? And that's kind of your point here, you know, and now we're leveling a bit of a moral criticism at the actual, you know, view by doing this. But I think it's, well, I guess that's why we're here. Do you want to start with that? That was a bit wandry. I know.
I think the idea that the church just has nothing to do with the state needs to get as far away as possible.
Yeah.
That idea is very amenable to modern Lutherans because we already talk about very little that has contact with life in our sermons and our teaching. It's generally an ideological system you assent to probably because you used to be an evangelical or you don't like evangelicals. And that has some political direction to it, right? Lutherans are going to be very dismissive of evangelical dispensationalism. That's fine. But this is very, very attractive to Lutherans because it means that your irrelevance. So let's say you just don't talk about the moral quandaries that, you know, your parishioners have at work because they are contributing to, I don't know what, you know, the enormous consumer credit crisis, right? And what they work for is a vendor that helps, you know, confiscatory levels of, you know, debt loads be put on, you know, your average person trying to make a living. And what they do at work makes that more possible, or makes it possible through an app that allows the person to basically go into debt even faster and with a slicker user experience, whatever the issue is, right? Okay, so you can just say, get out of that. We'll only have, and Anabaptists often do this, we'll just have work for you that we do. So you'll work for one of two companies run out of this congregation. Okay. And I think a lot of people, that's kind of what they want, right? That's the vision in a lot of people's heads when they're talking about communes, right? And they want like a Lutheran commune, or they want, or there actually are Catholic communes. That's what they want, right? They just live in a pure world. It's a shallow view of sin that Anabaptists have, which is why they always end up doing these sort of monastic patterns of life. So you can tell what their allegiances are based on what the women's head coverings look like and what color buggies they're driving. I mean, I'm being serious. They go into that because they go into a very monastic understanding of sin, where sin consists in breaking the outward taboos established by the group. And if you're not doing that, then you're good, right? You're in good standing. The difficulty is you can set up your commune, you can do all that. Now you're together. Guess what? Somebody's going to try to cheat somebody else.
Yeah, right.
You can't.
Right.
The problem, the reason you have government is because government is set up to deal with the kinds of things that even if you try to be purely religious in a communal way, you're still going to have. You will create a government. Okay. Even if you're trying to be.
You will need a rule. The monastics, yes. You will need a rule, right?
You will.
You will need a reign. It must happen.
Yeah. But I think the reason this is so attractive to people is that it takes the difficulty or the confrontation that they could either have with the larger government and says, well, you're just gone now. You're just out, right? You are the Mormons going to Utah. You're out of America now. No problem, right? Problem was America came to Utah, right? Or it also allows you to say, look, like, I can't fix this. I can't do anything.
Exactly.
So you can indulge your own despair.
Yes.
By saying, that's okay. Yes. My despair means that I'm pure.
Yes. Yeah. You said it, that a government that no one follows, listens to, that has no force to exercise is illegitimate. And there's a sword in a stone right in front of you. And evil all around. And you say, but I'm a pacifist. And someone goes, thank goodness I don't have to pick up that sword now. Let's run and hide. Right. And and it is. It's a freedom from duty.
Yeah.
That is really quite cowardly in the end. And I don't mean to call everyone who's ever uttered pacifistic thoughts as cowardly. They're nostalgically beautiful. It's a beautiful nostalgic picture you paint. It's absolutely beautiful. I love it. Paradise probably won't be like that, actually. But there'll be some level of what you're longing for. They're in paradise. I'm convinced of that. Here, though, again, I even where you're talking about, like, so you're in your commune and you're all religious and you're all going to grow your potatoes, you know, out of dirt
and
on
your
cardboard.
Beards. Yeah. Potatoes grow down, beards grow down as well. Yeah.
And somebody, you know, lies, somebody cheats, someone steals. And even here, it's like government, religion. Why? It's good and evil, right? It's right and wrong. And you have the power of the word, and you have the power of the sword. You have that which wins by influence and that which compels by fear. And these two ways in which creation operates, ways in which, frankly, the church in the world operates as we see it versus as she is unseen. And then certainly the way that governments in their religious fervor also operate, that's all here in this. And so that's where I again find this conversation incredibly helpful. And hopefully we still have time to look at government as neutral tool, which is my note for John Locke's third way.
And we'll just give more time to this another time, because there's plenty more, and he goes into discussions of what's now called Christian nationalism and what the reformers talked about. And so it's all pretty interesting. The third view is the idea of the government's religious neutrality, meaning you separate government and all religions of any kind, and the government just has to leave them alone. And this is either that, and you can see both of these things in American history, because I think what I just said is what a lot of people thought the United States was. I'm contending it's actually secular suppression at this point.
Amen.
That what we were doing was this view number three. And there are kind of two forks to this. One, the government promotes no religion whatsoever. And that historically, recent history, let's say last 20, 30 years until maybe 2010, 2012, 2014, that was sort of your left-wing version of what America was supposed to, that it just promotes no religion. Your right-wing version was America promotes some generic civil religion that would be expressed in the military chaplaincy, that would be expressed in, you know, a ceremony at the White House Christmas tree lighting or something, right? And so your options there would then center on debates like, should we have private school vouchers? Well, Republicans say yes, because it's okay to give money to Lutheran schools, and it's okay to give money to Muslim schools, and it's okay to give money to Jewish schools. Democrats would say no, don't promote any of it, you know. And so what effectively happens is that everybody is supposed to just leave everybody else alone. We just disagree about what we could do or might do when we're together, right? So should we have a civil religion or should we have no civil religion? But we definitely don't have the government handling anything involving any particular religion. And the reason that this is so familiar is that it is the view of what Nicelli correctly identifies as classical liberalism. So that's not particular to the left necessarily in these terms from the French Revolution, because they're also there in John Locke, who's very formative for many of our founders, not all of them, but some of them particularly. And I've been contending, and I'm still going to contend, the Virginians are probably your most liberal in this sense of the founders. And for somebody like Jefferson, this is the idea, right? Is that you just leave religion to sort itself out completely separately from the government. Along the lines of Locke and of Jefferson, this is also basically what the Missouri Synod has always thought America was. Mm-hmm. This is, you hear this in C.F.W. Walther,
right?
And you hear this in Walter A. Meyer endorsing the Jeffersonian ideal of religious liberty, is that this is what America is. So we have this giant opportunity because there's no particular religion. I mean, and in a way, it's like the Missouri Synod is endorsing what Nicelli calls pluralistic secularism, that does not necessarily deny God's existence, but wants to keep the peace between opposing religions. And we're like, okay, great. You know, we'll take it from here.
because
we get to be left alone, right?
And then ever since,
right? Because what we fight over, because we're positioned on the right in this discourse, in this political debate, we fight over the extent of civil religion. I mean, what else are our fights about Yankee Stadium and everything else except what degree does the Missouri Synod participate in American civil religion? Well, that assumes that there is one and that you should participate in it. And what that assumes is that the government and the religion are totally separate. They just are. And any contact, and so now we're just going to talk about, okay, we're totally separate. We live in totally separate houses. Are we ever going to shake hands? And if we shake hands, what is the handshake going to be like? But that's it. It's just a handshake. Then we go home. So this idea, this view number three, is really probably the most familiar to anybody, even though I think it's passing away.
Yeah, Captain Americana, baby. Are there any, to your knowledge, operating versions of this ideological, social, religious experiment in the world today as nation states? Number three.
In the minds of Americans only.
Yeah, there you go.
Not as a regime, no, because America was uniquely clear and pure in its articulation of this. And I just mean pure as like a an evaluation.
It is our religion. Number three is our religion.
Yeah.
So we're back to number one again.
And it still exists in the minds of Americans.
Absolutely.
And it's the basis of our really kind of radical, ahistorical idea of what free speech is supposed to be. and we'll get into that as we talk about the Continental Reformers and stuff later on next week, a week after, whatever. I think it's all very interesting because you can only say whatever you want, absolutely whatever you want, anybody, anytime, anywhere. You can really only do that if you're saying government's job is to leave people alone to have whatever opinion they want and to articulate it however they want, whenever they want. And this is, I mean, this gets that sort of idea about human expression or the political idea, the political theology idea that we just articulated. You would probably call it, if it were just sitting alone on its own somewhere, like in a think tank in a country that's not America, you'd probably call it libertarian. So in the same way that if you go into the history of basically anywhere in America, but just take the Wild West, for example, basically gambling was normal and then it was outlawed and then Nevada brought it back, is that in the same way our default is so intensely libertarian in a way that goes way beyond anything that, you know, the Independent Institute or Ayn Rand ever specifically articulated, that the Mises Institute ever had a conference about. It's so deeply libertarian. It's kind of hard for us to see it usually. We just assume view number three, unless we've been educated to believe that secular suppression view number one, or some of the other ones we'll go into in other weeks, is somehow more convincing. But I would say view number three, I don't actually think it exists anymore, except in the minds of many Americans.
Yeah. So again, I'm gonna say it's effectively view number one in its practice now, as its own form of governmental religion that can't tolerate any other religions. Oh, but then saying that, I have let my question fly away. Oh, here it is. No. So it less a question, more a comment, and I know we're wrapping this up too. So that it is so ingrained in the influential waters of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod so as to probably impact most other American Lutheran bodies that are not already mainstream far left 2023 liberals. The LCMS is kind of the grandma ship in many ways, culturally and iconically. And the operating assumption of us all in the water is like the air we breathe. No one even questions is that position number three, Locke, Jefferson, government, the neutral tool. We got a good thing going here in America because we can really build and they'll let the church grow. That's what we've all believed. You can't help but believe that to some level. You're trained with it all the time. It's what we do. And if we cannot wake up from that, then we're done, right? I would say that almost all of our other repentance issues, up to and including what does family planning mean, roll out of this very same issue that we don't realize they are targeting us with their weapons. Their weapons are not guns. Their weapons are songs and pictures.
I think even if let's say they weren't targeting us, let's say like the governor of Minnesota, Walls, I can't remember. I'm just picking like the most Lutheran state I can imagine. The governor of Minnesota is like, Jonathan Fisk, I would like you to come be Bishop of Minnesota and rule over all the Lutherans therein. And please open every session of our legislature with a very, very Lutheran prayer mentioning justification by faith and the Blessed Reformer. Please come do that, Jonathan. Even if that were all happening, the idea that the things that government deals with are completely separate from the things that religion deals with.
Yeah.
Already has made religion irrelevant. That's how view one slides into view three so easily. In the same, for different reasons, then view two slides into view one, slots in there in the position that the government might want it in, because it means that the government, for instance, is just going to regulate divorce and religion has nothing to do with it. The government will regulate marriage and religion has nothing to do with it. And in that case, then you very readily, and this is how this, you know, this is how this can work, view three, that they're completely separate, sort of degenerates into view two, that you just want to get away because you have so much experience of being completely separate and having your life completely determined by people who have nothing actually to do with you, that you just, now you just want to get away. And now you're sitting ducks and you can be much more readily suppressed. So what you're dealing with in view three easily goes through a process by which it turns into view one. But I think it stops first at view two, where you're like, well, they're obviously not neutral anymore. They're actually disgusting and horrible. So let's try to get as far away as we possibly can. You were already trying to get away by saying that they were totally neutral.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you got it. Hey, Actual Baptist, we're coming for you next. You're listening to Brief History of Power. You know where to find us, or you wouldn't be here.
The Hebron Collegium is a gap year Bible school for men in Rockford, Illinois. Semi-monastic boot camp for Christian living. Cowards and slackers need not apply. HebronCollegium.com.
What do you think of when you hear the word college? Expensive? Liberal? Woke? Imagine a college that is affordable. A college that is unapologetically conservative and Lutheran. A college that won't take a dime of federal funding. A college that teaches the best of our Western heritage. A college where students grow in the Christian faith instead of leaving it behind. This is Luther Classical College. A college by Lutherans and for Lutherans. Visit our website, lutherclassical.org, subscribe, become a patron, and join the thousands who are making Luther Classical College a reality.
At 7,123 feet, you can find mountains soaring above you and rivers running swiftly in the valley below you. Natural beauty of every kind. But our God is richer in his gifts than this. At 7,123 feet in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, you can also find God's word preached purely and his sacraments given out for your salvation at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School. Located off US 160 just west of downtown Pagosa, Our Savior offers your children a wonderful place to learn of Christ and his wisdom week in and week out, and offers you the medicine of immortality Sunday in and Sunday out. Our Savior Lutheran School provides a Christ-focused classical education that enriches the child's soul with the best that has been thought and said to the glory of God. Whether you visit while vacationing or hunting in the beauty of the area, or whether you would like to join a group of faithful Lutheran Christians, Our Savior Pagosa Springs has what you're looking for. Divine service with Holy Communion is each Sunday at 9 a.m., and Bible class follows at 10:30. At more than a mile high, you will find Christ in all his glory in the midst of his people at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School, a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. Find out more at oslcpagosa.org.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, historic Christian Orthodoxy, the evangelical Lutheran faith in the beautiful inland Northwest.
We'll be right back.